Tonight, we're going to learn a little bit about the thought of a Jewish philosopher, theologian, who has intrigued and troubled me for many years. And before we get into the meat of his thought, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how I came to be enthralled with his writing and why I find it to be so rewarding as an object of study. So I was introduced to the writing of Michael Wishegrad in the Hadar Beit Midrash in the summer, I believe, of 2014, when Rabbi Scheiheld gave a shiur weekly class on modern Jewish thought. Most of the figures that we covered, I was familiar with to one degree or another. Wishegrad was totally new, both in terms of his existence, but also in terms of his approach, his content. He was a writer who provoked and upset me in ways that theology had rarely done until that point, and just kept me wanting more. And Wishegrad is rewarding to study for me because by nature, I am a religious person. And when I go to religion, the reason that I am drawn to the sacred stories of the Bible and rabbinic tradition, I am actually looking to learn something about the way the world is. I am looking for a message. Good news, if you will. But news. And there is a tendency in modernity when many of the foundations on which Jewish and other systems of religious thought have assumed to rest have been seen to wobble by people who don't want to give up the life of Torah and mitzvot, who find themselves deeply drawn to, comforted by, shaped by Torah in ways that they don't want to give up, to try to figure out a way in which you can still say the words of the prayer book with a good conscience, even if actually we're in substance giving up on the main points of the story. That a God with a personal name at one point in history entered into the picture, established a unique relationship with the Jewish people, gave us a code of law by which to live, and will one day redeem the world. And there is a great deal to be said about the trends in modern Jewish thought that I have just sort of condescendingly hand-waved away. It's not all to be dismissed. But Wishegrad takes a stand in a way that is very unique in its rhetorical ferocity and its depth for saying, actually, before we do anything else, we need to try to take the Bible seriously on its own terms. And the subject we're going to talk about tonight, what it means to understand God as a person, a personal God, is an area of thought where he does that with, I think, particular depth and insight. So before we look at Wishegrad's own writings, I'm going to ask a question to the assembly. This is a real question that I want you to try and think of some real answers to. How do you personally relate to the fact, positing that this is a fact, that the God we meet in the Bible and the prayer book is a person, or a personality, if that is a more amenable word? And a follow-up question that you may also consider: to what extent, if any, does your answer change if I specify that we're interested in an intellectual plane rather than a spiritual, personal, devotional plane, something like that?
I think my natural reaction is to minimize it. So for example, just use the Bible, right? When you're looking at a story where God is acting in a certain way, I think my natural inclination is to focus on the human actions that cause God to act in that way, whereas minimizing the focus on God's being.
So, reading those as reflections of human action or human society, etc. few other reactions. Yeah.
I think I have a...
Ben?
Yeah, it's a strong default instinct to say it's a metaphor, it's muscle, and even if I'm intrigued and find it really interesting that, like, the Torah chose to portray God in that muscle, of all the different ways to help us understand God, and use even one, there's still like a lingering sense of me if that's just surface level. Real God, the God behind the scenes, the God between the lines, doesn't have a human personality. I'm just getting this little reflection that's helpful for others.
So maybe there is some real phenomenon that I experience which has something to do with God. It's not just people making stuff up and writing it down, but the God beyond God, as Paul Tillich put it, is beyond personality. And two more at the back there, and then we'll go on. Atara, first.
I'm less bothered by the fact that God has a personality, like that somehow feels intuitive to me. I'm more challenged by the personality that God is portrayed as having. So it's not like weird to me that God has a personality. It is some parts of the way that personality is expressed is.
So if God never got angry, but responded to every transgression of B'nai Israel with like this well of compassionate understanding, that might be different.
No, that's fine. No. Okay. Well, it's not other than
too compassionate.
I'm a late game, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Josh.
Well, I guess I would say that I feel like in the earlier of my own learning, I fully got the message that love must be a metaphor because the real God is the unchanging sort of prime mover kind of Maimonidean God. Having kind of long since been been disenchanted with that, I come back to this and say, well, the emotion of God's reactions at least reflect an intense and deep relationship. Mm. And so whatever you want to say, what's the true nature of God, at least this clearly conveys a sense of, like, because it is because we are in such a deep relationship with our family, children and family, that we get angry, that we respond intensely.
Okay. Thank you for your reactions. I cut it off there. There's a number of different ways, I think, schematically, that people react here, some of which have been reflected in these comments. People can react with embarrassment. This shows that the Bible is a document of sort of childish intellectual proportions belonging to a time earlier in human history when they didn't understand how things were and just projected their own personalities on a big screen. Sometimes people respond with indifference. Sure, that's how it is. I live my life. I keep Shabbos. Shabbos is nice. Don't really bother much with thinking about the person who's supposed to stand behind it. A little bit in Josh's comment there at the end, sometimes people can respond with enthusiasm. Because if God is a personality, then one possible corollary of that fact is that what I am, a personality, and the phenomenon which bonds personalities together, namely relationship, is in some way, it might be seen to follow, the deepest thing there is. Relationship and personality go all the way up and all the way down, as it were. So what Visegrad wants to argue, and this is what I think makes him particularly interesting on this question, is that neither embarrassment nor simple enthusiasm are, in fact, appropriate postures to adopt to the fact of God's personhood. Instead, Visegrad wants us to sit in the uncomfortable middle place, where we say at one and the same time that God's personhood is indispensable and impossible. That in fact, the indispensability depends on its impossibility. And Visegrad makes this argument by drawing on two important strands of modern Jewish philosophy. The first is that of Maimonides, Rambam, a Spanish, later Egyptian figure of the 11th century. The second is the Danish Christian philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, who is very influential on all manner of modern philosophy. So I'm going to take you through the ways in which Visegrad first sets up a kind of almost crude-seeming defense of the personality of God as a way of attacking Maimonides. And then the way in which, in order to be a good Kierkegaardian, as we'll see, he has to actually argue that in a certain way Maimonides is correct. What does it mean to say that Maimonides is correct? Maimonides is usually considered to be the premier rationalist of the Jewish intellectual tradition. And he's associated with the idea that philosophy and Judaism are, in some sense, compatible. What he really meant is the source of endless controversy, but that's, let's say, the received naive interpretation of Maimonides. His most central, perhaps, and most controversial idea, I think, definitely, was a radical anti-anthropomorphism. So what anthropomorphism means is the ascription of human-like qualities and characteristics to things that are not human, the thing in this case being God. And Maimonides dedicated his intellectual work to stamping out the idea that God was in some sense like people from Jewish thought. That was his aim. And two lines that capture this approach well from Yigdal, which is the hymn that we sing on Friday nights, which is in fact a versification of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith that, as I say, encapsulate this well. One, Echad ve'ein yachid ki yichudo. God is a unity who is totally unlike anything else. God's unity is not so much numerical, but rests in uniqueness, unlikeness from anything else. The second line, Ein lo demut haguf ve'eino guf. God has neither a body nor any connection to materiality at all. What is it that Rambam is another way of saying Maimonides, why does he feel so strongly about this? Shortly put, there's an idea about perfection, which he inherits from Greek philosophy, which says that anything which is physical or composite is less perfect than something which is less physical or less composite. Because being a physical entity, being composed of different attributes or components, means that you are subject to change and decay. And the farther you can get from those things, the more perfect you are. So Maimonides embarked on a mammoth project of intellectual reinterpretation, of taking the Bible and going step by step, every place where it seems like the Bible is describing God as getting mad, as walking, as doing things that are drawn from human experience, the language is either to be understood as metaphorical or as educative, telling you how you should behave, how you shouldn't behave, etc. The Bible uses anthropomorphism, Maimonides argues, as a concession to human needs. But actually conceiving of God in anthropomorphic terms, taking those seriously as statements of truth, is, Maimonides says, idolatry. And the stance with which Visegrad is most publicly associated by his own desires is a total rejection of this. And this is what you'll find in the first text here on your page, the Introduction to the Body of Faith, which was his magnum opus. He writes, Maimonides' demythologization of the concept of God is unbiblical and ultimately dangerous to Jewish faith. Jewish faith cannot survive if a personal relation between the Jew and God is not possible. But no personal relation is possible with an Aristotelian unmoved mover. Very clean, very nice. He now turns to a humorous anecdote to help drive the point home. The story is told of a yeshiva student who loved to pose riddles. One day he posed the following to his friend. What is it? It sits on a tree branch, it is red, and it sings. His friend guessed various creatures, such as birds, squirrels, plants which make a noise in the wind, etc., only to be told that he did not have the right answer. When he gave up, he was told that the right answer was a pair of tefillin. When he protested that tefillin did not sit on a tree branch, were not red, and did not sing, the riddle master replied, "Ah, those things I put in to make it harder." If the Torah, Visegrad writes, depicts God as having emotions, as changing his mind, as walking in the Garden of Eden and being angry at a disobedient Israel, it does not do so because it wishes to communicate that the opposite of all these traits is true, that God has no emotions, God never changes his mind, God never walks on earth, and God is never angry. If the Torah had wished to teach these ideas, it would have taught them, and not their opposites. This is certainly a way of talking which is unusual for someone who moved in the sort of Upper West Side modern Orthodox milieu that Visegrad called home. And for that, by itself, I would say this is an interesting moment in intellectual history. But if Visegrad left it there, he would not have the kind of profundity which has drawn me back to him over and over again. Because as much as I said at the beginning that the reason that I am drawn to religion in the first place is because I am looking to actually learn something about the way the world is, I think we simply cannot hand-wave away the problems, philosophically framed, which have rendered the concept of faith problematic, not just in the modern period, but perennially, in the Middle Ages as well. Those same problems which drove Maimonides to his project of reinterpretation stand with us today. And if all Visegrad did was say, well, Rambam is a heretic because he says that that God has no body and the Bible says God does have a body, that would be, as I say, interesting, but it would lack a certain profundity. And thankfully for Visegrad and for us, that is not where he leaves it. There is another intellectual move that he makes. This is in an essay from 1966, in which Visegrad actually does a complicated move. He takes up the mantle of Maimonides to argue against the kind of naive anthropomorphism that you would associate with him from the paragraph that we just read, in which he took pains to make sure that people associated with him, in order to, at the end, return to a kind of chastened and more prayerful appreciation of anthropomorphism. So the setting for this second essay is the following. In the mid-60s, there was a rabbi up in Riverdale named Rabbi Shlomo Danziger, who launched something of a polemical attack on the work of Visegrad, as well as that of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz and Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, now associated with this institution, saying that these modern Orthodox theologians were too cute by half, too interested in modern European philosophy and their Heidegger and their Kierkegaard, and not really willing to come out and say what they believed. And in particular, it seems strange that he would include Visegrad in this group when making this argument, but in particular, he said that they were too cagey about whether they believed in the literalness of revelation. As he put it, the literal objective truth of Vayedaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, and God spoke to Moses, saying. So despite the fact that he was not really the main target of this polemic, Visegrad took it upon himself to answer. And the result was a series of letters back and forth in the pages of the Jewish Observer, in which Visegrad pointed out to Rabbi Danziger that, as we know from Maimonides, it is in fact very problematic to speak about God's speech. To which Danziger replied something like, well, of course, God doesn't speak the way I do and you do. God does not have vocal cords. But it's perfectly fine to say that God has intentions which are communicated to the prophet. And when the Torah wants to tell us that, it says God speaks. To which Visegrad responds in the essay that we're about to see some passages from. And his argument there begins with the assertion that actually not much is done from a philosophical point of view by saying that while God may not have a body, God is sort of like a big ghost who has the same mental characteristics of human beings. He says, and reading here from the page, there are in fact grave difficulties involved in making such an assertion. When I am told that Mr. Green is thinking a thought or has a desire, I generally understand the meaning of such an assertion because I, too, have had thoughts and desires, and therefore assume that Mr. Green's are rather similar to my own. But when I attribute thought or desire to God, am I to understand by this that God has thoughts or desires in the same sense which humans do? The difficulty, however, and this should be surprising to you, I would posit, based on what we just read above, is that just as no physical characteristics can be attributed to God, so no other attributes can be attributed to God either. From Maimonides' point of view, there are two reasons for this. The first is that if God had any attributes whatsoever, his unity would be threatened, since anything that has attributes is a composite. The second, and probably more compelling consideration, is that no attribute that is used of both God and man has any common meaning whatsoever. In the words of Maimonides, here he quotes from the guide as an authority, there is, in no way or sense, anything common to the attributes predicated of God and those used in reference to ourselves. They have only the same names and nothing else common to them. Now here, it's important to point out that Maimonides is functioning as an authority. He is being invoked because he is part of a textual canon to which both Visegrad and Rabbi Danziger are accountable. And so if Maimonides says that a philosophical argument has weight, it has weight. The particular system of metaphysics on which Maimonides' objections to anthropomorphism is based is questionable. It has it has long been superseded in the halls of philosophy. But the problem can be restated in more modern terms. It could be restated in Kantian terms. The concepts which we use to furnish our thoughts come from the realm of space and time and can have no purchase on anything outside space and time. And this is a basic problem which Visegrad wants to say cannot be gotten out of in any cheap way. Continuing on. The disturbing problem that this line of reasoning leads to is this. Since there is no common meaning to any attribute applied to man, to God, and since we derive our insight into the meaning of any term from its sense as applied to man, I am simply left without any understanding whatsoever of the meaning of any term that is jointly applicable to God and man. The case I have outlined here is the religious philosophical argument against the knowability of God. Its strength is derived from the insight that by uncritically speaking of God as willing, commanding, loving, and warning, an inevitable humanization of God occurs by attributing to him characteristics which cannot possibly apply to an absolute being who is altogether one. If God exists outside the realm of space and time in which we live, then at some level, it simply cannot be appropriate to describe God in spatiotemporal terms. And it is important, Visegrad writes, to realize that there are no easy or cheap ways out of this problem. Here is where Visegrad's Kierkegaardianism comes in. So Kierkegaard was, like Visegrad, a kind of anti-philosopher. That is to say, he's somebody who used the tools and texts of philosophy to undermine it from within. And Kierkegaard's big concern in the mid-19th century was with making authentic Christian existence possible in a world where Christianity, Kierkegaard thought, was impossible because it was too easy. Christianity, Kierkegaard posited, comes into the world to teach you something insane, something strange, even revolting, that the absolute being enters space and time and takes the form of a particular man who is then tortured to death. And yet people become Christians not by confronting this incredible challenge to every idea that they normally make recourse to understand the world, but by being born in Europe. That's how you become a Christian. You're brought to the baptismal font at the, as a baby. And so his project consists in large part of emphasizing the difficulties intellectually and morally that stand in the way of somebody who wants to be a Christian. He talks about having to crucify your understanding. And in this context, he's associated with the idea of the leap of faith, that faith cannot be reached through a process of argumentation. Actually, what is necessary is to use philosophical argumentation to show how faith is problematic or even impossible, to dig a ditch for yourself that you then jump over, as it were. And here, Visegrad's Kierkegaardianism comes into play. Like I said, for Kierkegaard, coming to be a Christian is to crucify one's understanding. For Visegrad, I would say it is Maimonides who furnishes the nails. And that is to say that he needs the Maimonidean arguments to be correct in a certain sense in order for us to appreciate what I've called the scandal of Jewish theology, that despite its seeming irrationality, we are confronted with a revelation of a personal God. Continuing on. Where does all this leave us? Must we remain silent in the presence of God to fulfill Wittgenstein's dictum that whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent? If all talk of God were the result of human initiative, the answer would have to be yes. Instead, it is God who descends to man. In the mystery of his freedom, he addresses man, permitting man to speak to him and about him. The Torah, and therefore God, speaks in the language of men, permitting his glory to be contained in human concepts. But this miracle of revelation can be accepted in gratitude only when it is seen to hover over a philosophical impossibility. This philosophical impossibility remains an impossibility in its rational integrity, even in light of the divine power which conquers it. It makes all possible difference, therefore, whether we proclaim the speaking and willing God before or after the realization of the philosophical impossibility involved. The naive anthropomorphism represented by Rabbi Danziger is simply inadequate. Maimonides is correct when he says that it is idolatrous. Before this realization, back on the sheet, our words are a deceptive piety which erode the majesty of God by reducing him to human concepts, which can be then applied to him literally. Such theological positivism, and what he means by positivism here is the uncritical acceptance of data, while often well-intentioned, is idolatrous and ultimately destructive of the living word of God. When the words which God applies to himself are proclaimed by the believing community in the full awareness of the abyss over which it hovers, and that's very Kierkegaardian language, of the limits of the human word, and of the power of the word which is God's rather than man's, theological positivism gives way to a theology of wonder and gratitude. Wonder over the presence of God with us, and gratitude for the condescension of the God of creation who becomes the God of Abraham, whose presence is miraculously preserved in the biblical word. Israel can therefore assert that God loves it, that he has chosen it from among all the nations of the world to honor it with his commandments, and that he will redeem this nation and through of it all humanity in the fullness of his time. And all of this is true, not literally, but in that ultimate mystery which entitles us to say what we say, and for God to remain the God who proclaims that my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts. A few words of conclusion. The first is a word of caution. This style of thinking, which is known as religious existentialism, has a certain predilection, as you may have noticed from the prose of these last couple of paragraphs, for pathos. It revels in the difficulties, the emotional, spiritual, sometimes even moral difficulties, the angst which besets people in the world, and in its religious instantiation, which besets people attempting to live a life of faith. And while it is important not to turn away in religious thought from the negative experiences of pain, of angst, etc., this way of thinking has a danger of fetishizing those, of turning pain and struggle into the ikar, the main thing, rather than God, who, after all, the Bible tells us is karov elecha me'od, very close. Then two more positive takeaways. Second is that for those for whom faith is difficult, and I would certainly count myself in that group, this way of thinking provides an understanding of faith according to which that difficulty is not a problem, is not a personal failing. On the contrary, it paints a picture where that struggle for faith is an act of heroism, is an opportunity for you to grow deeper in your relationship to God and to faith. And finally, it makes the very most basic acts of devotion, opening a siddur and saying, Baruch atah, blessed are you, opening a Bible and reading stories about God's interaction with the people and with individual people, into moments of the miraculous. Every time we speak to God, we are, according to this line of thought, doing something that ought to be impossible. And if you really internalize this, what Visegrad calls a theology of wonder and gratitude, your life may be transformed.